The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. It's a real pleasure this month. Our topic this month is topics related to ear, nose, and throat medicine. It's a real pleasure to welcome Steve Kelly on this month. Steve is one of those guests. Most guests, I have to do a little research to know anything about them. But Steve and we're contemporary. We went to medical school together. So we probably know more about each other than either one of us would want to disclose. I think we had lunch together every day the first 2 years of medical school.
Pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. You were very smart, though. I think you're bracing yourself for a guy asking dumb questions, and you're the smart guy who can sort through it for me.
Well, we'll see.
Well, I think we will see. Steve, so obviously we went to medical school together here at the University of Utah, and you did your residency here as well, and then you did your fellowship at Johns Hopkins. Is that right?
That's correct.
And then you have been practicing pediatric ENT in the Salt Lake area ever since, right?
Ever since. That's correct.
Very exciting. Well, before we dive right in, are there any conflicts you need to disclose?
No conflicts.
Not even with me. That's pretty good.
I don't think so, Paul.
You've buried the hatchet after all these years. That's a good thing. The first two topics that we'll talk about this month are really, in some ways, like bread and butter, clearly bread and butter for you. But I also think that over time, a lot of stuff kind of gets confused about these things. And I think it's always very helpful to be able to talk systematically. So this week, we want to talk about ear infections. That's something you know a lot about. It's something we see all the time as well. But I think the way we collaborate about them is probably fairly important. Can we start by just reviewing, how does an ear infection happen?
Well, a lot of it, you know, centers around the eustachian tube. So things that cause eustachian tube dysfunction will predispose to otitis media. So whether that's upper respiratory infection, sometimes allergies may contribute. Sometimes it's an anatomic thing. In young children, we know that the eustachian tube is smaller in diameter, sits more at a horizontal angle, which with any little congestion predisposes to eustachian tube dysfunction, a negative pressure in the middle ear space and accumulation of fluid. And then sometimes that's secondarily infected with bacteria.
Now, just addressing a couple of things that we still hear from grandmas from time to time, does getting your ears cold cause an ear infection?
No, cold should not affect it.
Getting water in your ears?
No, water is okay as long as you don't have a perforation of the tympanic membrane or a patent tympanostomy tube, then water sometimes can be problematic and lead to infection.
Now, what about incorrect nose blowing technique? We hear that one sometimes.
Well, certainly if you are blowing the nose hard, you can certainly force too much air up the eustachian tube. It's possible if you blow extremely hard, you could rupture the tympanic membrane if you're able to force enough air up, you know, in a short amount of time under a lot of pressure, it could rupture the tympanic membrane, but it doesn't happen very often.
Is the middle ear usually a sterile space? Are the germs there all the time, or do they have to come in from the pharynx?
We believe that they come in from the pharynx. You know, most of the time, the middle ear is an air-containing space lined by mucosa. I don't think a lot of people have really tapped normal ears, and, you know, there's really no fluid to draw off to culture anything, but we believe it's a fairly sterile space. But with fluid in the middle ear space, certainly that can be a start to a bacterial infection. We know that if you biopsy, for instance, the adenoid tissue and send that for tissue culture, you will find many of the organisms commonly found in acute otitis media and acute sinusitis in children.
So are they usually there?
Yeah, they're often there. Uh-huh.
Is the pharynx in any way like the gut, that there's a normal flora and that disturbing that flora may cause a preponderance of more harmful bacteria, or is it just is what it is?
Well, certainly there's a lot of bacteria in the mouth, in the oropharynx, the nasopharynx, hypopharynx. There is normally a lot of bacteria in those areas. And I think theoretically, an upper respiratory infection may alter things and predisposed to, you know, an overgrowth of the more problematic bacteria that we see in sinus and ear infections in kids.
It appears that some viruses facilitate ear infections. Is that more than just congestion? Are some viruses sort of like facilitators, co-pathogens almost, that change the dissemination patterns?
I think that's the case. You know, like I say, the viruses will cause inflammation of the, just like they cause inflammation in the nasal cavity, congestion in the nose. There's a similar respiratory lining of the eustachian tube, and it'll cause congestion of the eustachian tube. Certainly alters that aspect. And how much it alters the normal flora found, a little hard to know, I think. But acute ear infections very commonly follow an acute viral upper respiratory infection.
And it seems like there are some viruses that are caused, and some that we don't see much anymore, but historically, when you read about measles, for instance, it seems that that one of the big problems with measles is a whole lot more bacterial infection in the wake of measles. And I was just wondering if there's something particularly about the virus that does that.
Not sure that we know. I mean, we don't really see much of that anymore. I think that was certainly more of a historical interest.
Has the microbiology of otitis media changed? For instance, does immunization for pneumococcus change either the incidence or the causes of ear infections?
The three common bacteria involved in acute otitis media and also in acute sinusitis in children are the same, really. That has not really changed a lot over the years. I think the pneumococcal vaccines have helped in preventing more severe infections, complications of otitis media. I think that has been shown after years of vaccination use. But really the, you know, pneumococcus is still the number one organism in acute otitis media, followed by Haemophilus influenza and Moraxella catarrhalis. And really the percentage of those, you know, which one causes the most, you know, most acute episodes of otitis media has been pretty stable over time.
Has the antibiotic sensitivity of those bacteria changed over the course of the last 20 years?
Yeah, it has changed. For instance, a lot of resistance has developed to azithromycin, for instance, many of those organisms. So initially when azithromycin was introduced, it was a very popular antibiotic to use, but probably very quickly overused because of the fact that it was only dosed once a day and for 5 days instead of 10 days, three times a day or twice a day. And so I think it was overused and there was a lot of resistance that developed fairly quickly to azithromycin.
And when you say there are fewer complications, by that you mean the spread to adjoining spaces?
Yeah, so the complications that we are most concerned about would be intracranial complications of acute otitis media, such as meningitis, epidural abscess, subdural empyema, intraparenchymal brain abscess, dural sinus thrombosis. These are very serious and potentially life-threatening complications of acute otitis media, but fortunately they're not all that common, but we do certainly see them.
Has there been any change in the need for ventilation tubes based on anything over the last while?
I think we probably are placing ventilation tubes or tympanostomy tubes less frequently than we used to overall. You know, there have been some guidelines that have come out in 2013 that, and revised again in 2016, that I think have reduced the frequency of placement of tympanostomy tubes, though still the most common procedure performed in children in the country.
What were the major changes from those guidelines?
The guidelines were not so much specifically to acute otitis media, but for chronic otitis media with effusion. And, you know, we let children have effusion a little more for a longer period of time before we jump to tubes. One of the more recent changes that came out with the revision in 2016 was that when a child presented for evaluation for possible tube placement, that if the examiner did not see effusion at that time, then it was recommended that we would still wait and not place tympanostomy tubes unless there were some other extenuating circumstances. So if the ear exam was totally normal when they came in for our evaluation, you know, we were encouraged to hold off a little longer.
Well, that's very interesting. Let's go back to the treatment of acute suppurative otitis media. When is it appropriate or even important to watch and wait instead of using antibiotics?
So that's another change that I think has been in place, and you know, that has come into play in the last 20 years or so. It used to be that, you know, every child that went in that maybe had an early infection was placed on antibiotic therapy. But I think children over the age of 6 months, otherwise healthy, not immunocompromised, with mild symptoms of, you know, less than 48 hours, it's very reasonable to wait and watch. If they're not getting better, or if they're having increasing symptoms of, you know, higher fever, for instance, lasting more than 48 hours, or experiencing other more severe symptoms, you know, that might make us worried about an early complication of acute otitis media, such as headache, nausea, vomiting, you know, altered mental status, anything like this would be more concerning. But I think if they are otherwise healthy, certainly reasonable to wait a couple of days before starting them on antibiotic therapy if they're relatively asymptomatic.
And how would you recommend proceeding with that? Asking them to come back in then, or use the so-called safety net antibiotic prescription where you send them home with something with clear instructions of when to start it? Any hints there?
Well, I think realistically, doing the safety net antibiotic is probably the most reasonable approach. I think it's very difficult for families to come in several times a week or even after a few days. I think if there's concern about reliability, then maybe we re-examine them. Certainly if we feel that their symptoms have increased significantly, then re-examining, I think, is very reasonable.
Have there been any major changes in what you would recommend in terms of antibiotic choice? Clearly, the macrolide antibiotics have sort of faded a bit because of the resistance issues. Any other advice there?
So I think, you know, amoxicillin still is probably the drug of choice in a child who maybe is not in a daycare setting or has not been treated recently, maybe in the last 30 days with an oral antibiotic. Amoxicillin is a very good choice. High dose amoxicillin for kids that are in daycare or maybe have been recently treated with antibiotics, still a good choice. Augmentin, amoxicillin, clavulanic acid, very good choice. For those that are allergic to penicillin, ceftonir is a good choice, though there's some cross-reactivity with those. Rocephin for IM injection, I think those would be my drugs of choice.
It seemed that a few years ago, and maybe it's still happening, I just don't know, that there was a lot of enthusiasm about thinking about pediatricians learning to do tympanocentesis and draining infected ears instead of treating them. Where do we stand with that?
I have not heard much discussion about that recently. I think in actuality, we don't do a lot of tympanocentesis. We did it a lot more 20, 25 years ago. Our indications for us as otolaryngologists would be in a child who is presenting that is quite toxic, that we want quick culture to see that we're concerned about potential complication of otitis media, tympanocentesis, or we often will do a meningotomy or even place a tube in those children but we haven't done as much with tympanocentesis, at least in our practice, for many years.
It seems like I don't see it offered at the CME conferences anymore. I do know that in his memoir on writing, Stephen King said that everything he knows about horror comes from having had repeated tympanocentesis growing up in the pre-antibiotic era. So that made me less enthusiastic.
Yeah, very uncomfortable procedure. So it can be done, but it's not super comfortable.
So who ought to get PE tubes? Are there a certain number of infections that would indicate that for you?
Yeah, in general, you know, we would look at 4 episodes of acute otitis media in a 6-month period of time, 6 in a year. Some practitioners will place it a little bit sooner than that. Again, you know, we're encouraged to, when we examine the child for a potential surgical candidate, that we would, you know, if there is no effusion at the time, then we would probably hold off if we can a little longer.
It seems that frequently, from our perspective, that 4th ear infection happens in April or something, and it's going to be spring. And so Right. Why don't we just wait and see what happens next year?
Yeah, well, there's certainly thought that, you know, children will have fewer infections. And I think that it's true that they have fewer infections in the warmer weather months, mostly because they tend to have fewer viral upper respiratory infections that often lead to them. And so, yeah, I think if there's a child who maybe is on the fence as far as numbers prior to putting in tympanostomy tubes, and it's the springtime and the weather's improving, certainly that discussion can take place between the parents and physician, and often will wait.
If a child's having a string of ear infections, is there a role for something that may decrease congestion like nasal steroids or decongestants?
In my opinion, those are of limited use. So for me, I'm not a big fan of nasal steroids for the treatment of either certainly acute otitis media or chronic otitis media with effusion. I think that the effect that the intranasal steroids have on the eustachian tube function is pretty limited. Some people will also prescribe it if they feel that there's some adenoid enlargement that may be contributing. They feel that the nasal steroids may decrease the size of the adenoid, and I'm a little skeptical about that. Now, sometimes in adults and older teenagers who develop not necessarily acute otitis media, but an otitis media with effusion and concurrent drop in their hearing, we'll often try them on a short burst of oral steroids, and that's often helpful. So I think the oral steroids sometimes can be helpful, but it's not really recommended in young children. And certainly with acute otitis media, we would not recommend that.
What about antibiotic prophylaxis? It seemed like that's something that used to be done. I have not seen it done for a long time.
Yeah, we've gone away from that. And I think the feeling was that maybe we were contributing to antibiotic resistance by doing the prophylactic antibiotics. So as far as we're treating acute otitis media and acute sinusitis, sometimes in the past, many years ago, 20 to 25 years ago, we were using a lot of prophylactic antibiotics, but we've really gone away from that.
Someone may have just identified how old I am. So thanks. I appreciate that.
Older.
If someone has tubes, what do you do if they start draining pus?
So you will see intermittent, probably at least a third to 50% of kids that have tubes in will have at least an episode of otorrhea when the tubes are in place. So you'll see that not uncommonly. Sometimes that's associated with water contamination. Sometimes that may be associated with a acute upper respiratory viral infection. And they, despite having a tube in, they develop an acute otitis media. So when the tube is in place and patent, instead of building up pus behind the eardrum, you'll see the purulent otorrhea. So very common. And what our approach to that is, we would preferentially treat the patient with antibiotic drops and hold off on oral antibiotics unless there was some other reason to put them on oral antibiotics. For instance, if they had purulent rhinorrhea with fever, et cetera, we might add an oral antibiotic.
Did you have a go-to drop that you use?
So I use a lot of the ofloxacin drops. We use the ophthalmic drops a fair amount as well. For some reason, even though it's the same concentration, the ophthalmic drops are much less expensive than the otic drops.
It seems that they're safe to put in your eyes. They're probably safe to put in your ears then.
Generally speaking, yeah, I think that's right. That's been our philosophy. So we do use a fair number of ophthalmic drops in the ear, and that's been good. The one caution I would say as far as drops, either with a patent tympanostomy tube or with a tympanic membrane perforation, avoid the cortisporin solution. So cortisporin solution burns when they get it in the middle ear. The suspension is better, though most otolaryngologists have gone away from the cortisporin just because of, you know, a fair percentage of patients that will have a topical reaction to the cortisporin of the ear canal. And so we don't use cortisporin too much. I know some primary care physicians still use it a lot, but be cautious, very, very cautious, especially with the solution, because that will burn.
Right.
Really, not really meant for middle ear use.
Good to know. So what other things should people with tympanostomy tubes avoid besides cortisporin solution? I hear different things. How much water can you get in there? Can you swim? Can you dive?
Yeah. A lot of controversy about water exposure. And there are some studies in our literature that would say you can pretty much do whatever you want with tympanostomy tubes. There are some otolaryngologists who believe that. Others would say keep the ears totally dry. Many of us, I would include myself, are kind of in the middle ground. So my recommendation is I try to avoid them submerging in the water in the tub, because soapy water gets in a little easier than non-soapy water. And I don't really like them deep diving into the water. If they're really submerging the ears while swimming, whether it be in a chlorinated pool or especially in a lake, which has a higher bacterial concentration in the water, I prefer that they wear plugs if they're submerging the ears. But there's many otolaryngologists who would say plugs are not needed.
And the plugs are just the ones you get over the counter?
Yeah, silicone plugs. You know, something like ear putty or something that's moldable. They don't want to use small pieces that they're pushing way down the ear canal. Those are very difficult to get out if they get stuck. So they want to use a larger piece moldable in the conchal bowl.
Is there a point that tubes should be removed? How long can they be in?
Yeah, so in general, there's kind of three groups of tubes: short acting, lasting, it'll usually stay in about 9 months or so, 6 to 9 months, intermediate acting, 12 to 18 months that they'll usually stay in, and then long lasting that they'll stay in even years sometimes. So
difference is in the structure of the tube?
Yeah, it's in the shape and structure of the tube and diameter. The longer lasting ones tend to be a little bit larger diameter. But if a tube, say in an average child with tubes that we anticipate that they're going to outgrow the tendency for acute otitis media. If a tube is staying in more than 3 years and they're not having otorrhea with every cold, et cetera, then we would start thinking about taking it out. In general, the longer a tube stays in, the more chance it has of leaving a hole when it is taken out or when it comes out on its own. So, you know, if it's been in more than 3 years, then we'll start thinking about taking it out, unless there's good reason to keep it in.
When should I worry about a hole in the eardrum?
Tympanic membrane perforations, sometimes a hole is okay. If it's a small perforation, a central perforation, meaning there's some surrounding tympanic membrane, it does not go all the way to the edge of the tympanic membrane, and they're not having debris building up in the middle ear space or chronic otorrhea, which might indicate a cholesteatoma, or the perforation is not up in the attic region in the superior region of the tympanic membrane, posterior superior region. Those are more worrisome for things like cholesteatoma. Sometimes we'll watch those if they're small and not affecting the hearing. There's many otolaryngologists that believe that if we wait until a child is maybe 7 or 8 years of age, until we're sure that they're out of the otitis media prone period, before trying to do a tympanoplasty or repair, that our success is higher. Others are more aggressive, may try to patch them sooner. But certainly if they're large, if they're prone to chronic otorrhea, if they are affecting the hearing, or there's concern of cholesteatoma, then those are the more concerning situations.
And throughout the period that someone has the perforation, then the same rules apply that you talked about with tubes and perforations earlier, that they should be cautious about water and whatnot.
Yeah, maybe even a little more cautious with a perforation. Most perforations are some can be very tiny. Some can be even a pinhole in the eardrum. Those, you know, it takes a fair amount of water pressure, you know, being under the surface of the water to get water through a very small opening. But most perforations are going to be a little bit larger than the diameter of the opening in a tube, for instance. And so water can get in more easily. So I think that if you have a perforation, probably a little more cautious with the water than even with the tube.
Excellent. Well, anything else? If you could change any one thing about how people like me generally treat ear infections, what would it be?
I think we still probably have a tendency to maybe over-treat with antibiotics. Not necessarily. I think we're better than we used to be in the initial acute otitis media. But I think sometimes we might see some of these patients back a little too quickly to reassess to make sure that it's cleared completely. So typically, after treatment of a child with acute otitis media, if we see every child, say, at about 2 weeks, shortly after they've completed a 10-day course of antibiotics, about 70% of those children will have some persistent middle ear fluid. And I think the tendency, at least in the past, and I think we're better than we used to be, but I still think there's some tendency that when we see that the ear is not totally normal, whether or not they are having persistent symptoms of pain or fever, the initial response is to treat them again with antibiotics. Where we know that if it's just middle ear fluid, not pus, that a lot of those kids will clear with time. So probably in a 3-month period of time, about 90% of the kids are clear, where at 2 weeks, 70% will have fluid. So
how long does it typically last in an infection? If I look at it on day 5, for instance, should I still see pus?
You may still see some pus. And I think the key there is the child getting better? Because if the child is not getting better and is getting worse, you know, after 5 days of a good antibiotic, then we may need to change the antibiotic. There may be a role for tympanocentesis if the child has severe symptoms, to get a culture, et cetera.
It seems like one of the risks too is that especially a child with a high enough exposure profile, family setting or daycare, is going to get sick every couple of weeks anyway. And there's always the risk that you're going to see an abnormal eardrum and wonder whether that's persistent effusion or whether it's a new infection.
And sometimes that's very hard to tell. And I think a lot of it's really dependent on symptoms that the patient has, fever, pain, et cetera. And sometimes in a young child, that can be very difficult. The child's fussy for a variety of different reasons, and it can be hard to tell. Certainly if there's, you know, cerumen impaction, I honestly don't know how the primary care physicians clean the ear canals as well as you do, because we have the microscopes and tools and everything. And sometimes even for us, it's difficult. So I think that, you know, that can be a big challenge in an uncooperative child, especially.
Yes, it can, as a matter of fact. The other part of that, too, as you mentioned, a child who's not very symptomatic would seem to be one who would fit your initial advice that maybe there are more of them that we can be watching and waiting.
I think we can.
Sometimes easier said than done, but
I think it is. It's hard because the parents haven't changed the mindset, I think, of many of the parents. You know, there's still an expectation that when they go to see the physician, that they're going to walk out with something, right? Prescription or something. And when they don't, I think that can be very challenging.
Yeah, having watched a lot of game shows growing up, it's what I refer to as the a lovely parting gift phenomenon.
Exactly.
That you want to leave with something. Well, Steve, thanks so much for your time and expertise. This has been very, very helpful. For those of you who have questions, please send your questions to questions@vcurb.com, and we'll address those in a couple of weeks. Steve, I look forward to talking to you next week. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.